Hi everyone, you're listening to Beyond the Benchmark, the EFG podcast. My name is Mo Zafzal. I'm the Global Chief Investment Officer for EFG. So today we have a podcast to go into depth on US equity strategy. So joining me today is Chris Seniak, who's the Chief Investment Strategist for Wolf Research. Chris, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Moose. Appreciate it.
And I think last time we had you was back in 2021. So it's been a few years since you've been on. And I think at that time we were in the depths of COVID and what was going to happen to financial markets. I guess a post-COVID at that time, I guess we were going into, I say, more uncertainty of when we'll all start to come out. But very different times now. The economy's roaring ahead at the moment. So maybe if I go straight into the first question. Recently, you wrote shifting to the no landing scenario as your kind of core thesis. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about no landing and why you've come to that conclusion.
Yeah, so, you know, we were in the cautious camp for really the last 2 years. 22, we thought there'd be a catch up with trying to fight inflation and the Fed hiking interest rates, and there'd be a bunch of earnings disappointments. And then as we entered 23, we saw the same thing. And in fact, this time a year ago, we had the regional banking crisis in the US, and everyone thought that that was a big bet. And the Fed threw a ton of liquidity into the system, which I think created this positive feedback loop of higher stock prices, greater confidence in a way, and said differently, a bit of a Fed put in the marketplace. And stocks never looked back, and the economy continued to surprise the upside. And when we entered this year, we were more cautious. We thought that the cumulative inflation effects were going to slow the U.S. economy. Europe was already slowing, and China was its own slowdown. And then what we've come to the conclusion is that notwithstanding, you know, the cumulative effects of how much inflation's been up, that people still have jobs, and there's been a massive wealth effect. In fact, the flow of funds data came out last week, and it suggested that since the end of 19, really since the start of COVID, COVID's 4 years ago, believe it or not, there's been $15.5 trillion of U.S. housing wealth, and there's been only $11 trillion of equity wealth. So housing prices went up. Folks are feeling good. 64% of folks own their homes in the U.S., and stock prices are also up, and including this year, you know, Bitcoin, right, front and center. And that's offset, I think, some of the negative effects of inflation eating into incomes. And perhaps now you even have a scenario where real incomes are finally inflecting positive, you know, adjusted for inflation. So we, you know, consumer spending is 70% of the U.S. economy. The consumer's hanging in there, and folks are continuing to spend money and stay out there. And I just don't see any reason how that doesn't continue over the course of this year.
So in terms of on balance, when you're thinking about maybe 6 to 9 months from now, clearly that wealth effect is having an impact on the consumer and consumer incomes, and of course spending. The cumulative rate hikes, do you think eventually we do have that? And how do you think that slowdown looks like? Are you thinking that it kind of tapers off, not really hit a recession? Maybe the Fed comes in a little bit earlier, but with modest rate cuts rather than, you know, thinking about trough rates of 2.5 or 2.75 or that many people have out there.
Yeah, so, you know, one thing is we think the Fed will let the economy run hot. And one of the reasons we changed it to be more constructive earlier this week was the Fed seems very intent on cutting interest rates, even at full employment, right? And their view, I think, and we can get into this more later, that real rates are too high And Powell's recently said, and other Fed speakers have said, that we don't need inflation to be at 2% to cut. We need it to just be coming down and getting better. And some of the recent inflation data that's been reported so far in March is very mixed, right? And I think ultimately inflation will prove to be stickier. But as we fast forward through the year, CEO confidence is improving because stock prices are up. You saw that with a recent quarterly CEO survey. CEOs feel better. They don't fire people. They actually do more capital investment. They start to do perhaps even M&A, which we're bullish on. And so I think there's going to be a bit of a slowdown on the consumer side. In fact, doesn't seem like it continued at the pace it has. But I think that's going to be offset by the industrial economy perking up again, too. China maybe being a little bit better, a rebuild of inventories in the U.S. So I think we're going to make up for any slowdown that we see in the consumer side with a little bit of a industrial pickup that we haven't seen in a while, because we've really been in this, you know, goods drawdown, inventory, you know, kind of recycle scenario. And that's across anything from machinery to analog semiconductors.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that when you look at the economic data and the way I've tried to sort of describe the economic situation in the United States, is that you've got, call it leading and lagging indicators. So lagging indicators were typically consumer services and kind of restaurants and that, you know, leisure experiences and travel, which obviously was a bit of a catch up from COVID. But the flip side, if you just looked at industrial economy and looked at ISMs being substantially below 50, you naturally would have expected a recession, right? And I think we didn't really have one because the US is still, you know, 80% consumer. And so we never really had that sort of, call it coincident slowdown that we normally associate with recessions. But because of COVID and the distortions that COVID created, we had, if you like, a desynchronous economy between the manufacturing economy and the service economy. And I think many people missed that desynchronization element over the last sort of 12 to 18 months. And you know, certainly our view, my view was that that synchronization will eventually come back again, but it will probably come back when we go to the next cycle, not necessarily the cycle that we're in because of that COVID distortion in terms of the, you know, consumer willing to travel and go to restaurants and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that that's right. I think that, you know, leading indicators, you know, was one of the core items that we look at as part of our investment process. And leading indicators, whether you look at the Conference Board Leading Index, whether you look at the ISM Manufacturing Survey, have been in contractionary territory now for 15 or 16 months. And yet we haven't had a recession. And so...
Well, inverted yield curve as well is probably the other one.
Yeah. It's the longest. I think we've reached the longest time this month in which the yield curve's been inverted, right? And there's been no recession. So there were a lot of signals last year that it looked like things were going to really slow down. But there was, as you point out, some desynchronization with the consumer economy, excess savings, and the industrial economy. And so I actually think that if the consumer slows down a bit, you know, you're going to get a little bit of a rebuild in the industrial economy to kind of absorb a bit of that. And at the same time, you've got central banks cutting interest rates, interest costs, you know, fall a bit, even if it's very measured rate cuts. Interest costs will gradually fall, and that will engender some more confidence for companies that, you know, to me, it's more about the change in direction of rates, short rates, than it is the magnitude of the cuts. Because I think it drives a big psychological impact on how companies think about the world, right? When rates are rising, CEOs don't know where that's, you know, we debate it and think about it every minute of the day, but CEOs are running real companies aren't doing that. And so they don't know where that high end rate will be, since a lot of things are based on floating rate. And so to me, the cut event, which it appears we're about to see over the coming months, is a very big psychological event, at least for companies.
So let's talk about that, a bit of a deeper dive on the rate, you know, environment. So obviously the Fed is pushing the real rate story, saying the real rates are very high, that needs to kind of come down. Otherwise, at some point, there's going to be a bit of an accident and, you know, the economy sort of tumbles very quickly. I guess that's the risk they feel at the moment. And, you know, the body language, the talk is all about rate cuts, right? And I think that's very, very clear. I think we call it, certainly back in sort of October, you know, Powell's dovishness was started kind of sink into fixed income rates and the equity market and the narrative very, very quickly. And I think it's that real rate fear that is driving the narrative on interest rates. So I guess in your point of view, the economy is still pretty strong, was looking stronger, all the comments you've just made, they could probably afford to keep that real rate high for a little while longer. Then the risk is that if it closed down very quickly because the economy slows, they'll move much faster than they otherwise would have done in maybe, you know, a couple of rate cuts rather than, you know, a couple of 50s being thrown in to recover from a sudden slowing in the economy.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think, you know, the Fed wants to cut rates, right? So we entered the year and the futures market was pricing in 6 rate cuts, which I think most investors we met with thought were crazy. And now we're down to 3 rate cuts almost on the spot. And the S&P is up 8%, right? And so it didn't do anything because it cut. And you ask yourself, well, why that happened? It's really because the economy came in better, right? Mm-hmm. So as I think about it, is that if we don't get the rate cuts, Moe's, this year, maybe if we only get 1 or 2, my base case is we get 3 and they start cutting in June, that it may not be a bad thing, right? Because the economy, maybe the economy is continuing to come in okay. I think inflation will continue to be sticky though, and that'll be a bit of a thorn in the Fed's side. But, you know, inflation's still going down directionally in the right direction, and I think Powell's very much intent on trying to cut interest rates. You also get into the dynamics, whether they're true or not, of, you know, does the Fed really want to cut right before the election if that's when they're going to lift off with the cuts? I mean, you know, it's hard to argue how, you know, there isn't some, I'm not saying there's political motivation for it, but you don't want to create the appearance of non, you know, non-independence. Mm. And so that's why I think they'll end up going this summer and maybe, you know, guiding to every other meeting.
Yeah.
And getting rates down to a little bit less restrictive. But the bigger question is, why haven't the rates really slowed the economy? Because it hasn't, right? Mm. And I think the answer to that is financial conditions are usually the mechanism through which rate hikes transmit to the economy. And the first series of rate hikes certainly started to push financial conditions to be much tighter. But in the last year, since this time last year, since the regional banking crisis, financial conditions have meaningfully loosened. And you see it in fixed income markets. Of course, spreads are, you see it in short term, long term. It's funding is easier to get. It certainly slowed housing when they first started to hike interest rates. But the traditional mechanism through which monetary policy is transmitted in the economy, I think, is a bit broken down. And what's happened in the last year with financial conditions loosening a lot has been that it's almost in a way unwound some of the rate hikes and worked its way through differently in the system.
I just wonder also how much of an impact, you know, foreign economies have had. You know, clearly Europe is much slower. You know, we were just talking a little bit earlier about ECB rate cuts and whether the ECB comes first before the Fed now. We're probably going to, you know, we're in the June camp as well. I did feel May until this latest CPI point print came out, but I think June seems to be the consensus, or consensus seems to be forming around that. But the ECB cutting rates probably in June as well. And of course, the big slowdown in China, which is obviously a big economy, has a big impact on the global economy in terms of commodity prices and so on and so forth, and price of goods anyway. Do you think some of that has been, you know, felt in the US economy, or certainly in the psychology of the Federal Reserve?
Well, I think it's been felt, but it's been offset by a lot of fiscal stimulus, right? And so fiscal stimulus last year in the US really surprised to the upside. Some of it was the IRA Act, the infrastructure bill. Some of it was just refundable credits from COVID for people that are that can apply to get money back, right? And they stopped that a bit. So, and then this year, year to date, state and local government spending has been coming in stronger. And so there's been still some of that fiscal impulse in the economy. And so, it, you know, usually monetary policy and fiscal policy are either aren't working, you know, in the same direct, you know, working against each other, so to speak. But this time, I think fiscal's sort of been muting what monetary policy has been. And I think the same thing with respect to China and the slowdown is that it has been felt in parts of the U.S. economy. Maybe we're even causing part of it because of the goods kind of restocking and destocking that's happened here from the COVID surge and buying goods. But it's been more than offset by, call it, domestic priorities and fiscal stimulus. Fiscal stimulus has been a big deal as well, and looks likely to continue at least through the end of the year.
Yeah, just on that fiscal stimulus point, what's your kind of view on Trump and Biden and fiscal stimulus? Who's going to be worse? they both look as though they're probably going to try and outdo each other on fiscal stimulus at the moment.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because neither of them, I mean, I think Trump is more of a spender than Biden, right? And I think there's proof in the pudding for that based on what he did back in the term that he had. But the Democrats also are, you know, not against spending and been free flowing. So I think Trump is probably worse for the bond market. But I don't think there's going to be a massive physical contraction. That the biggest item that they're going to have to deal with, apart from, you know, more sectoral stuff, is extending the individual tax cuts, because those, remember, the corporate tax cuts that were permanent, but the individual tax cuts that they did sunset at the end of 25. And so the big bill that they'll need to put through next year, likely through reconciliation process, will be a tax extenders bill. And if Trump's, you know, put in office with a Republican Congress, they'll likely extend all the cuts, right, including the highest earners. If Biden's in there, depending upon composition of Congress, they'll likely be more of a push to not extend them all. And said differently, the higher earners maybe not extend those or tweak that reduces ultimately the size of the bill.
And that's certainly going to mean worse fiscal deficits, not necessarily improving ones. I guess the only thing that
I don't see him improving. I mean, I just, there's been no physical constraint anymore. I think any physical conservatives that were in the House of Representatives before, have they retired or have just not going to vote against more spending until you get some type of revolt in the bond market, right? Mm, I thought we were starting to see some signs of that last fall when the 10-year U.S. Treasury went from 4 to 5. And then the Treasury came in and allayed a lot of investors' fears by, you know, kind of changing issuance and coupons that they want to issue and kind of lean more towards shorter duration treasuries.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important point. They did kind of do a bit of a twist in that respect to fund at the short end, and that certainly did alleviate a lot of concerns that people had around the future funding. I think one thing we just need to bear in mind is that the economy is much stronger than people anticipated, and capital gains and all those sort of things are pretty high. So I suspect tax receipts are going to be pretty good, certainly for the next sort of 6 to 12 months, at least if the markets and the economy stay strong. But I just wonder whether tax receipts are probably going to be a bit of a surprise on the upside.
I think you're seeing it already. You know, a lot of tax season is started in the U.S. and April 15th is the big deadline where you have to make the payments. And there was a news thing actually just out before we started this recording about how the Treasury's scaling back a little bit of issuance next week on 3-month T-bills. They're kind of not a big amount, I think $5 billion, but the tax receipts are coming in better, refunds be down. And, you know, relatedly, maybe we see a little bit of a little weak patch in the economy in April, maybe into May. If you know, you never feel good about writing a bigger check to the to the tax authorities, right? So maybe consumers just psychologically, you know, pare back for a month or two and take a respite. But I don't think there'll be anything more permanent there. But this is really the past year, right? And this is the first year where even if you weren't invested in equities, you know, you could sit in the money market and earn 5%, right? Close to 5%. But most people forget that you have to pay taxes on that.
Yeah, no, exactly. So yeah.
I think tax receipts will come in better. But the deficit, I think, you know, ultimately ends up being probably larger this year when all the dust settles than it was last year.
Yeah, and I think that's inevitable, and I think next year is inevitable as well. And I think you're right, there will be a puke up in the bond market at some point.
The other thing, you know, we're watching lately is if the Fed ends up doing a little bit of a twist with, it seems like in some of the recent, and I wonder if it's because they want to get the yield curve uninverted, but they've been alluding to in some recent speeches and seminars about potentially doing a twist like they've done before with less, you know, issuance on the front end and actually more on the long end. So it could steepen the yield curve a decent amount, which I think might help the banks. I think their banks are likely complaining to them that it's tough for them to lend and dig themselves out of a hole with a inverted yield curve that's been inverted now for almost 2 years.
Yeah, not quite.
So we're watching, you know, Fed. You know, Fed's got a couple key messages, decisions they need to make. Obviously, tapering, quantitative tightening. We'll see. You know, we should find out more about that this meeting next week or May. I think more likely May. And if they do some more operation type twist with respect to the curve.
Yep, I think that certainly all makes sense. So moving on to, I guess, the big question all of the active management industry has at the moment is the sort of broadening out of the market, smaller companies in particular, which obviously have hugely underperformed over the last 2 or 3 years on a relative basis. And then, of course, some of your recommendations around forgotten cyclicals, but maybe you can tackle the small cap answer first in terms of, you know, what do you think are the key catalysts to kind of get that sort of small cap trade working again?
Yeah, and I think that trade, the small cap trade, is part and parcel of the broadening out of the broader market. It's said differently, an equal weight indices doing better than the market weight indices. And so I think the key catalyst for that is folks truly believing in a longer economic expansion, right? I still think that people may be positioned in secular growers because they still have a few questions in their head over whether we're going to have a recession or not, or a significant slowdown. And so I don't think they want to go all in on small caps or other more cyclical areas of the market. And the reality is the stocks with the cheaper stocks in the market are financials or energy, some areas of healthcare, maybe even utilities now. And so I think the catalyst for the broadening out, which frankly we've seen already. I mean, the Mag 7 index peaked about a month ago. Mm. So beneath the surface, there has been some broadening out. But the key catalyst is, I think when we're staring in the eyes of central banks cutting interest rates, and it becomes clear they're going to cut in the face of a resilient economy, at least in the U.S., investors will want to own more cyclicality and stylistically smaller size. I think small caps are the most compelling area of the market for the next 3 years by far. But everyone that's tried to be early has been burned. They're one of the few areas of the market that's cheap. Now, arguably, they're cheap for a reason right now, because 35% of companies in the Russell 2000 don't make money. Financials as a sector are the biggest weight. Neither of those are new things in past cycles. It's always been the case when you kind of come out of a cycle. We had an explosive rally in small caps after Trump was elected, but I don't think we need Trump in office for small caps to work. But I'm saying that could be a second leg to that small cap trade. And so I think the small cap trade is consistent with the broadening out. And the broadening out trade to me is about what I call forgotten cyclicals to work. And what is a forgotten cyclical? Well, it's a in a very colloquial way, hated sectors, but more on a more minor level, it's areas like financials, capital markets, businesses, you know, that are and do well with improving M&A activity or IPO issuance or just more activity overall. Two is short cycle industrial stocks that most investors in industrials, and we like industrials as a sector overall, those are names where, you know, you need increased business activity and some tailwinds probably from China for those to outperform. Most investors have been leaning more into longer cycle industrial stocks because those are the ones that have, you know, more leverage to the Infrastructure Act and the IRA Act and so forth. Third is autos, which, you know, ex Tesla, right? I don't want to get into names, but traditional autos, like they're, you know, if you think about it, if interest rates start to fall, car affordability improves. The average age of cars on the road in the U.S. is over 13 years. Right now, the biggest obstacle for new car buying is just the overall size of the payment for that car each month. So not, you know, kind of what I call kind of traditional auto stocks, I think are certainly a spot to be. And an area that I think is super interesting is analog semiconductors, right? So there's, you know, been all this hype over the AI semiconductor names because the analog semis, which are much more levered to the industrial economy, right? You know, whose exposure is automotive and other traditional shorter cycle industrials have had inventory correction for the last 12 months. But that inventory levels look like they're improving in such a way that it'll start to be a tailwind in the back half of this year. And those stocks are much cheaper. They haven't moved as much. And I think could be an area where we see rotation. So I call them forgotten cyclicals because folks haven't really chased them. At a higher level above that, I'd say financials and industrials are two sectors that we like as, you know, the Fed cuts interest rates. We're still modestly overweight tech. I think tech, you have to be more selective. We'd still be leaning into and positive on AI leverage names, but be more selective than, you know, said differently is that don't go all in on the Mag 7. I think you got to be more selective within the Mag 7. I kind of call it, there may be the Fab 4, or maybe even the three amigos that were down to within that universe. So that's all consistent with the broadening out of the market. I think everyone's waiting and trying to think about what the catalyst would be. But I think people just broadly need higher conviction that this expansion is sustainable. And I think the Fed's starting to cut interest rates, where I think there's still a debate of how much they're going to cut and when, is the key catalyst. And every mistake I've made investing wise over the last few years has been trying to think two or three steps ahead. I'm trying to think in the moment.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I think I guess active managers ultimately will have a bit of a bias anyway to smaller mid caps and the story around smaller mid caps, but it's been very, very tough over the last, certainly over the last three, well, 2 years in particular, but even kind of pre-COVID, because you've just had such a powerful group of companies that have just done, you know, fabulously well. But I think your point is actually well taken. And the 70, do you think the Russell 2000 is more sensitive to rate expectations more than it has done in the past? And do you have any evidence of that?
I think it is. For one, the debt maturities are higher for that universe than they've been in a while. The percentage of unprofitable companies is modestly higher than some past peaks. The compositional effects of it with financials a little bit more, biotech a little bit more, are more important than they were in the past. So there's definitely evidence that it's more more rate sensitive than it's been in past cycles.
Interesting. So moving now on to one point you made a bit earlier was around M&A and the M&A cycle in general. What are the kind of catalysts you're looking for? What sort of things are you looking for on M&A? And then obviously, what else are you looking for on the IPO side?
Yeah, so M&A's already started, right? You know, it's back to Merger Monday where we wake up and there's been a couple of deals announced. And M&A to me is always about first confidence, right? And so when that CEO, there was a CEO confidence number that was released last week and it showed confidence being up a decent amount. And that confidence is probably up because stock prices are up, among other things. Let's face it. Mm-hmm. So M&A comes first and capital markets follow. So I think there's a lot of pent-up M&A demand, which I think stems from a couple things. One is, I think some companies aren't growing like they used to, right? They're not being able to get pricing, you know? And so when you can't get pricing and you want to grow, you start to look to growth, you know, grow through external sources. So I think there's certainly, you know, growth is slowing. Let's go buy something. We can't get pricing. I think some companies are buying because they can cut cost and also maybe get exposure to, you know, workers, right? In healthcare, you know, some M&A can be that companies are just trying to get more exposure to workers or certain things. So M&A, I think, is there's just a lot of pent-up M&A that got contained into the bottle during COVID and you know, a lot of people are circling the wagon. But for M&A to happen, generally, you got to have a decent, you know, bond market, right? Spreads have to be tight enough that companies can issue debt. So I think that's it. And I think if the Fed and other central banks cut rates in the summer, that adds further fuel to the M&A market and, you know, private credit and the like. And then the IPO market tends to follow, right? The first thing that, you know, if things come unthawed, first thing is M&A, and the second thing is IPOs. I've argued that in 6 or 9 months, we could start to see unprofitable, maybe no revenue type AI companies go public if markets remain hospitable. This could just be the start of it. And so I think there still is a decent amount of backlog of companies that want to and will choose to go public. It's just a confidence game, and I think the Fed cutting rates will be an important part of the IPO market. The number of IPOs the last 2 years has been at almost near record levels. So we've been at a total, and you don't tend to see 3 or 4 years in a row of a really weak market. So we're very bullish on capital markets activity picking up, M&A, IPO secondaries. There's, if you think about it, there's a lot of private equity firms that also want IPO, the businesses that they bought over the last 5 to 7 years. And that's why one of the areas of the forgotten cyclicals we like is, you know, kind of capital markets type business, M&A boutiques. We all know who those names are that kind of leans into those trends. And I think, you know, assuming we have a no landing or even a soft landing, I think those trends are multi-year trends. They're not just sort of a once and done. The other catalyst later in the year, you know, could be if we have a change in Washington, right? I think Trump clearly would be much more receptive to deregulation. You know, FCC gets reworked, SEC gets reworked, and could be a big deal. If you think about the mergers that have been blocked and, you know, apart from, you know, being hard on China, which I think both presidents want to be, I think a Trump win would be another way and wheel to grease the M&A and certainly the M&A market and probably capital markets by extension.
That certainly makes a lot of sense. Moving then on to, say, foreign markets, and obviously not your direct coverage, but how do you think about foreign markets and their influence on the US and US investors in general? I mean, what are the pushbacks you're hearing from your clients?
Yeah, you know, we've done a lot of meetings. I do a lot of calls with overseas investors. I did a bunch of calls with Zooms with Asia clients recently. They're still not super bullish on China by any stretch of imagination. I think, you know, one of the reasons the U.S. market has done so well, and particularly tech, is that I think a lot of investors view China tech as somewhat uninvestable. And then they have to look for other places to, you know, invest in tech, and it comes into the U.S. So I think that continues to be a very strong and salient point that clients are looking for U.S. tech exposure and not China tech. You know, remember a couple of years ago, you know, some of the China tech names were all in vogue and money went that way. It seems that money is going in the U.S. In fact, I had some very constructive and a bit heated conversations about how clients were arguing how tech stocks weren't expensive and I were arguing how they, you know, are pretty expensive. I think some are cheaper than others. So, you know, there's a lot of, I think, passion about that. You know, the one, I think, thing we hear from a lot of global investors is that everyone is bullish on India. But beyond that, you know, where do you, you know, as a big country weights, where else do you go? Europe, you know, sort of there isn't a lot of excitement. And so I think a lot of the money flows, and you see it in the data, has flowed into the U.S. We're starting to see some interest in South America because central banks have been cutting interest rates a bit sooner there and loosening policy, whether it's Brazil, Mexico, some of the other areas. There's not a massive weight in the MSCI, but nonetheless areas where people are looking for opportunity. And of course, Japan, everyone is now bullish on and after a long period of time. And I'd say that continues to be, apart from India, the area that people are unanimously constructive on in calls and meetings across the globe for global asset allocators. And we're constructive on Japan. It's not my favorite. I'd rather own India or China, but I think there's no reason to think that Japan can't continue to do fine. Its valuations are not terribly expensive. They're going to hike interest rates likely and lift off from zero rates, but that's not necessarily a bad thing there.
Yeah, I'm going to say, I mean, now just got to new high since 30, from 35 years ago. So it's...
Who would have guessed?
Exactly. No, it certainly is the market du jour at the moment in terms of its focus. So Chris, we're nearly coming up to the end of our time. What are the other areas that you're constructive on? What about some of the kind of healthcare, biotech areas? Obviously, biotech is an M&A beneficiary. But any other sectors that you're constructive on?
We like biotech. Biotech's going to benefit from lower rates and some of the names that are levered to the biotech spendings, like some of the labs and other names. MedTech, I think, is interesting. There's always a lot of good idiosyncratic stories in medical technology as a subsector. Pharma, we're lukewarm on, just because I think we all know that, you know, the growth is in some of these GLP names, but those are very, very expensive, and the other pharma names they're cheap, but I think they're value traps in some ways. So we're kind of leaning out of there. And, you know, I'd say the most hated area, the most 180 swing in sentiment is in managed care. So, you know, I think managed care has been a darling for years, and managed care names have fallen out of favor, and rightfully so, because they have some cost pressures. There's been greater utilization of procedures, people getting knee replaced and hips because they didn't do that during COVID, and obviously they don't make money on when, you know, a lot of people show up to get elective procedures. But some of those cost headwinds should fade in the back half of the year. And perhaps once we get past the election, that could even be a catalyst for some of the managed care names. So, you know, they were darlings. The business hasn't dramatically changed the structure of the business. And I think that's if you have a 1 year plus time horizon, I think managed care is quite compelling here.
Interesting. You talked a little bit about pharma. I guess, is that, you know, related to the, Inflation Reduction Act? Obviously, a lot of farmers, and particularly the big wonder drugs, start to get impacted from that. Is that in your psychology at the moment? And I guess if Trump comes in, you know, maybe that gets quashed or certainly watered down?
I think there's always concern over drug pricing. And I think the concern is that Trump would be less, less of a headwind for drug pricing than a Biden administration. So I think, yeah, I think the clarity event for that would be the election. I personally don't think either of them are really going to pursue a lot of serious drug pricing reform. Some of that's already happened under Biden, but the market is always concerned about it. And so the clarity event will be the election for that, for sure.
Mm. Excellent. So Chris, that time flew by today. Thanks very much for coming on again. Lots of very interesting takeaways for us to kind of digest and to think about. And always a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Good to chat with you. It goes by so quick. I can't believe it. I feel like I could talk for another hour, but we'll save that for another time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So again, thanks, Chris. So that wraps us up for today. I want to thank you for listening in to Beyond the Benchmark, and we'll be on again soon. Thank you.